From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Pokemon Detective Pikachu, starring Justice Smith and Ryan Reynolds. Tolkien tells the story of the author of Lord of the Rings, Nicholas Holt stars. And The Hustle, a comedy starring Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson. We'll also talk about the history of black cinema in our Film Week feature on Film Week Today. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Justin Chang of the Los Angeles Times, Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association, and Charles Solomon, animation critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Pokemon Detective Pikachu. When Detective Harry Goodman goes missing, his 21-year-old son Tim tries to find out what happened. Aiding in Tim's investigation is Harry's former Pokemon partner, the wisecracking Detective Pikachu.
Did you just talk?
Whoa. Did you just understand me?
Oh my God! You can understand me!
Stop!
I've been so lonely!
They try to talk to me all the time. All they hear is Pika Pika.
Can no one else hear him?
Don't need a Pokemon, period.
Then what about a world-class detective? Because if you want to find your pops, I'm your best bet.
Pokemon Detective Pikachu is directed by Rob Letterman, who co-wrote the screenplay with three other credited writers. Justice Smith, Ryan Reynolds star. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this is a textbook example of Americans taking a popular, and in this case, beloved Japanese animated property, turning it into a live-action film, and basically stripping it of all the elements that made it popular and enjoyable and attractive. Pikachu talks for the first time, which he's never done in any of the hundreds of TV episodes and two dozen films, and he never shuts up. He natters constantly. It's an overblown plot with somebody out to... For some reason, the evil villain, who from the first time you see him, might as well have evil villain stenciled across his front, deciding he wants to combine people and Pokemon, which makes no sense whatsoever, even within the world of Pokemon or without. There are endless Morris the Explainer scenes. There are bodily function jokes, sitcom one-liners. I thought it was just a mess, and I couldn't wait to get out of it.
Claudia, what'd you think?
I did not enjoy it particularly. I probably didn't hate it quite as much as you. I will say the evil villain was played by Bill Nye, who I love, and was kind of wasted, although he was whatever. He was what he needed to be, which was one dimension. Ken Watanabe is also in it, you know, a thankless role. It might as well have been, it could have been anybody. It feels like an extended product placement kind of movie. You know, there were some interesting visuals. The city that it's set in, yeah, looks like a combination of Tokyo and London and maybe a little New York,
like
a Blade Runner kind of look, which is, you know, it was taking this world and making it into kind of a noir landscape, which was sort of interesting. It was like bizarre and formulaic, which is a very strange combination. And I like the bizarre part and obviously the formulaic part.
It was also basically Roger Rabbit meets Zootopia with a few elements from Big Hero 6 thrown in to...
Sounds good to me, Charles. you know, and in line with kind of the visual distinctiveness of it, this movie was shot on 35mm film,
yes,
which is almost unheard of in this day and age. And I don't know if it creates a somewhat more interesting and slightly better textured and lighted look to me. It doesn't just look like the usual CGI gunk explosion. I have zero frame of reference for this movie.
Me too.
I
know nothing about it.
No, and I...
But you had the Oracle sent Charles.
Hey, I am a Pokemon master. I have won a number of the different games.
Charles is that.
I saw it with you, and I kept leaning over going, so who's that and what's that?
Well, I cannot tell my lickety tongues from my Jigglypuffs or whatever. I probably butcher the pronunciation. But I have to say, so I have no frame of reference, and so I found this weirdly diverting for someone who's coming to it with no background whatsoever. I couldn't tell you if it's good or not. I couldn't tell you if this is extremely weird and surreal or if it's just par for the course for this universe, even if it is sort of this offshoot. And I don't know. I know the Pokemon is popular enough. I don't see anything inherently wrong with taking it in a different direction from the original concept, necessarily. And I like the way it commits to this sci-fi noir genre, which is sort of an counterintuitive fit, I think, for this character, and I kind of liked that about it.
I want to see Justin's version of Gone with the Wind, where the South wins the Civil War.
I'm not going to touch that.
Yeah. So you really enjoyed it, sounds like, Justin.
I think my attention sort of dropped off in the middle as it becomes this sort of blur of action. But I found it disarming throughout a lot of it. And I liked Justice Smith. And I have a lot of tolerance for Ryan Reynolds.
I like Ryan Reynolds, too. Although the wisecracking did kind of get on my nerves by the end. Yeah.
Pokemon Detective Pikachu, Justice Smith, Ryan Reynolds star, Rob Letterman direct. It's rated PG in wide release. Tolkien explores the formative years of the Lord of the Rings author. Nicholas Holt stars. Domay Karakoski is the director of the film. David Gleason, Stephen Beresford are the screenwriters. Charles?
Well, as the resident Tolkienist, this is really my geek day. First Pokemon, now Lord of the Rings.
You're the master. You're the master of our first two subject areas.
Charles, I think the term is Tolkienista.
Okay, I'll take it. I remember at some speaking event, someone asked Ursula Le Guin, "Did you really read Lord of the Rings aloud three times?" And she said, "Of course, I had three children."
Oh, wow. Those poor children.
I've been a Tolkien fan since I was in high school. And this is Tolkien in his younger years as an orphan at a posh boys' school and then at Oxford. But it's not terribly interesting. There are more interesting things about Tolkien in this period that they're not telling. They suggest that he got the ideas for all his fantasies from the horrors of the Battle of the Somme. And you even see the fire and smoke of the battle forming like the figure of Sauron. Well, maybe. We do know, though, that while he was studying with the learned professor of ancient languages, who's played by Geoffrey Rush, he found a couplet in an obscure Old English text that translates out to, "Hail Earendel, brightest of angels, sent above Middle Earth to men." And he fixated on that couplet and what it could mean. And that's what his universe and languages kind of crystallized around, because Earendel will become one of the key figures in the entire Tolkien universe. For those who aren't too familiar with it, he's Elrond's father, among other things. They also spend much too much time on his high school chums having tea at this one little place and being friendly and supporting each other. When he was a professor at Oxford, which you see at the end as he's about to begin The Hobbit, he was part of a circle of writers, professors, who called themselves the Inklings, and that included C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
And it was Tolkien's religiosity that helped to bring C.S. Lewis back into the church, which, you know, was ultimately the source of the ideas for his Narnia Chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that I believe there's a movie in the works about Tolkien and Lewis, which is such a fascinating relationship.
That would be a much better
source material.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And in terms of, you know, the way that Tolkien, you know, unlike, say, Lewis with Narnia, where the allegory, the religious allegory, is very explicit in the Lord of the Rings, it's much more implicit, I think. And so that was one of the things I had a problem with this movie, exactly the way you said, Charles, about how it does sort of a one-for-one ratio, like, oh, yes, so he's got this soldier named Sam, of course, therefore, yes, you know, Samwise, you know, in Lord of the Rings. And it's very reductive that way, and which is a shame, because I think that there is some lovely filmmaking here all the same. And, you know, it sort of caters to a kind of Anglophilia where you're sitting in the tea times and the libraries, but it's a very comforting world to spend time in. I just don't think it's terribly insightful in the end about his creative genius.
Too much tea and scones going on there. Yeah, it has that sort of burnished, polished, you know, English biopic. Yeah, which, you know, like Theory of Everything and some others. But so it looks handsome. And I think Nicholas Holt did a pretty good job. But the story is dull and it's superficial, as you both have been saying. It's just not revelatory. I didn't get a sense of Tolkien at all, and way too much time with his cohorts, you know, with sort of having their camaraderie. And I don't think you needed that much time. And then also they spent a lot of time with the romance between him and his wife, which I thought you didn't really feel the chemistry between them much. So
I liked her and Lily Collins. I thought she was good. And I think they try in those scenes to give you some sense of the basis of Middle Earth with the languages. I mean, I think languages, the structures of language, the musical sounds of language. That's
cellar
a very
door.
Hard cellar door. There's
cellar
the cellar door.
Door
to be. I actually really liked that
I
scene.
I like that too.
They're trying to get at something which is hard to present cinematically, I think.
Absolutely. Yes, you could do it much more in a literary fashion.
It was very much languages and their sound that fascinated Tolkien.
Yes, which is what drew him to create
to finish into Middle English and Early English and Norse and so forth. But again, I just didn't get much out of the movie.
Mm-mm. We're talking about the biopic Tolkien on J.R. Tolkien. Nicholas Hoult stars. Domé Karakoski, the director. David Gleason, Stephen Beresford wrote it. Rated PG-13 in wide release. In the film The Hustle, a comedy with Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson, we have an exchange between the two scam artists played by the stars. It's directed by Chris Addison, Stanley Shapiro, Paul Henning, Dale Lawner, and Jack Schaefer are the screenwriters.
Tell me, Penny, why are women better suited to the con than men?
Because we're used to faking it.
It comes down to one universal truth. No man will ever believe a woman is smarter than he is. We will always be underestimated, and that is what we use.
So this means you're going to teach me, aren't you?
I'm teaching you now.
Yeah. Wait, what was that last part? I couldn't hear you were talking into the ocean.
The Hustle, Anne Hathaway, Rebel Wilson. Claudia, what'd you think?
This is not the movie to prove that women are smarter than men, sadly. This was a generally pretty unfunny and kind of regressive remake. It flips the genders on Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It has, you know, maybe intermittent flashes of comic chemistry between them. You have, you know, Rebel Wilson with her physicality and Anne Hathaway with sort of her arch, sort of, you know, withering bone mows and things like that. It's not terrible. It's just faint, damning with faint praise there.
There's the lead. No one will be hurt by seeing it.
Put it on the poster.
Not terrible, Claudia, please.
It's not terrible, says Claudia. It's just tired and predictable. But a lot of comedies are tired and predictable. And here's where I feel like this is where I'm going to defend it a little bit. I feel like critics are harder on sort of the reboots that flip the genders, you know, whether it's Ocean's 8 or Ghostbusters, because critics are mostly men. So these gender swapping comedies inspire very, very intense ire. And I don't know if there's just some inherent sexism in that. I don't know if it's related to like women running for president, you know, women in positions that are normally taken by men. But, you know, there have been so many bad comedies with men. I will say that.
They typically are identified as bad comedies with men. So.
Generally, but they're not. They don't inspire the kind of, you know, real anger that I think this might be inspiring to some degree. But, you know, it's not about gender. It's not trying to make any statements about gender. It's very, you know, inoffensive. It's just about con artists, basically. And it's not that funny. It's a beautiful setting. It's, you know, the kind of thing that if you were on a plane, maybe you could, you know, sit through, especially if you're on your way to the south of France where it's set. But other than that,
get you in mind.
There's a lot to be said for listening to a plane's engine hum.
The Hustle, a comedy with Anne Hathaway, Rebel Wilson, Chris Addison directing, rated PG-13 in wide release. Nonfiction, a French romantic comedy drama starring Guillaume Canet, Juliette Binoche. The film is written and directed by Olivier Assayas. What do you think, Justin, of Nonfiction?
I like it a lot. Assayas is sort of, he never makes the same movie twice. And yet, I think the theme that comes through his movies, whether it's Summer Hours or Personal Shopper or Carlos or what have you, and now this one, is the contemporary world in a state of continual flux and the forces of globalization, the forces of technology. And here he has taken those themes and realized them through a bourgeois sex comedy, basically, that is set in the Paris publishing world. And so you have characters like Guillaume Canet, who plays a literary editor, Vincent Macken, who plays a novelist whose novel has been rejected by this editor. Juliette Binoche plays the editor's wife, who is having an affair with the novelist. It's lovely. This movie is so
very French.
Unrepentantly French movie, you'll see in a while. And I love that about it. And it's kind of doing it in a way that I think is having a lot of fun with that and poking fun. It's like her characters never stop talking. They never stop having sex. It's like they're kind of the same thing. They're just doing them, and sometimes with passion.
Same time, yeah.
But a lot of times just because it's something you do. You just keep talking. But what they're talking about are things that don't sound like promising ideas for a film, which is the way digital technology is affecting arts and the media, something that all of us in this room are very conscious of.
Claudia?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I thought, you know, the sort of the combination of their mutual infidelities and looking at the digital age and what it means and fiction and sort of the pretensions of personal fiction, auto fiction, as they called it, and midlife crises. And the crises were kind of both personal and cultural. And it works. I like talky things. And I like the French.
Well, they make it very interesting in terms of, like, you know, decline of public libraries and e-books, and it's good stuff.
It is.
The film is nonfiction, starring Guillaume Canet and Juliette Binoche, written and directed by Olivier Assayas. It's rated R at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and the Arclight in Hollywood. Coming up, we'll hear about the comedy Palm, starring Diane Keaton, Pam Grier, and Jackie Weaver, and the documentary The Biggest Little Farm. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our next film that Claudia and Justin and Charles are going to take on is Palms, a comedy starring Diane Keaton, Pam Grier, Jackie Weaver, and Rhea Perlman. Zara Hayes, the director, Shane Atkinson, the screenwriter. Claudia, what'd you think, Palms?
Oh, boy. well, like, remember when I said it's not terrible and the other one? This one actually is terrible. You know, these women deserve so much better. When you have a cast like Jackie Weaver, Diane Keaton, Pam Grier, Rhea Perlman, Celia Weston, you just, you know, these are wonderful actors, and they can be so funny. And, oh, my God, the overall premise of this was just flawed to begin with. It feels forced. It feels problematic. The basic theme is it's never too late to follow your dreams. So, yeah, true enough. But why would the dreams of an older woman who is dying of cancer, who's apparently smart and substantial, focus on being a cheerleader? That just, you know, the very premise of it is just kind of problematic. You don't buy it. And you learn nothing about the women. None of them are given. She maybe has a couple characteristics, which is that she was a teacher and then she's dying of cancer. But other than that, the roles are paper thin, one dimensional. She leaves. We found out in the very beginning she's been living in the same apartment for 46 years. She leaves to go live in a retirement home, which looks beautiful. It looks, I mean, actually sort of like paradise. It's manicured lawns and houses and all these, you know, things to do. And she's miserable. And everyone has to join a club. None of the clubs that are there appeal to her. So she decides to form this cheer squad because she had never gotten to be a cheerleader. She tried out a few times and it, you know, it just is hard to believe that this character would ever do this. So I, you know, maybe this might have worked if it was an SNL sketch or something like that. I'm not even sure that would ever work. But it wants us to laugh at these older women even trying. And at the same time, it wants us to admire them. And you can't have it both ways. And so none of it feels forced. None of it makes sense. It, you know, when they do actually try out, everybody scoffs and young girls jeer at them. And that would never happen. You know, it doesn't operate in any universe that we're familiar with.
And it seems like such a waste of talent.
Complete waste of talent. It's just it made me sad.
Palm, starring Diane Keaton, Pam Grier, Jackie Weaver, and Rhea Perlman. It's in wide release and rated PG-13. The documentary The Biggest Little Farm tells the story of Molly and John Chester as they trade in living in the city for 200 acres of farmland and their dream of living in nature. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, first, in full disclosure, at the Times Book Festival, I did a panel with John Chester, who was very nice, but I liked this movie. He and his wife got a rescue dog that barked constantly. They were evicted from their Santa Monica apartment. So they decided to take on 200 acres in Moor Park that had been an orchard at some point. The land was dry and dead and full of invasive species. And with some guidance from various people, they started planting diverse crops and cover crops and using the animals to trim the crops and in turn fertilize. And they built this farm into something where the cycles of nature are actually taking place. Things are born, things die, they return to the soil. The soil is enriched. The one thing they really don't tell you is they needed investors to do this. They don't say how much it costs to set this up or if it's actually showing a profit at this point because they're marketing their eggs and some of the stone fruit that they grow.
Yeah.
And it's a beautifully shot. Some amazing footage of the critters that are invading the farm at times, like coyotes and raccoons and owls. Very warm, very just a family film in the best sense of the word, I'd say.
And well made.
Yes.
He's a longtime documentary cinematographer.
John Chester.
Yeah, John Chester. So you see that. It is beautiful. There are times it's so beautiful, it looks like some sort of storybook, like old MacDonald had a farm with these beautiful, these sheep that are black and white and the sheep dogs that, you know, you just,
Moore
the critters.
Moore Park's pretty, too. I mean, it's pretty to begin with.
Well, yes, Park, yeah. Especially when you pick, you know, you really get the parched land irrigated and everything. You start growing all these things. But that was my biggest problem with it, was the problems that they encounter are kind of glossed over. And their situation is one of privilege. I mean, you know, they had a lot of people working for them. And it was wonderful.
And
you
volunteers.
Volunteers. And while I found it inspiring and uplifting and beautiful to watch, you know, you wonder where they had the wherewithal to keep it all going. And I would like to have seen a little bit more of that in the documentary.
Yeah, I was worn down by this movie gradually. I think it starts off a little cutesy. The music is somewhat overbearing, and there's just the nobility of their effort is sort of emphasized to the almost vomitous degree. Not quite.
It's good for the soil.
It's good for the soil. It's all good for the soil. And that is what I like about it. It did wear me down. I think it does give you a portrait, this somewhat extraordinary cross-section of nature, and the message of the movie is that nature gives and nature takes away, and it's constantly having to lock wits with nature in some ways, and also, but in the end, let it take its course, you know, whether you're trying to figure out how to deal with the coyote problem or how to deal with all sorts of things. And just the imagery is not, and it's beautiful, but it's also harrowing at times too, which I like about it.
Gives
it
a little,
the fires that they're threatened, of course, by the California wildfires. You know, just lots of images of maggots and animal poop and bloody corpses left behind by the coyotes.
We said it was pretty.
And just,
now
it's lots of secretions in this movie. Lots of
little adorable piglets.
You know, it's
born.
It is interesting to me though that of all the farmers who have these very same issues that you can make a film about, it's the couple from Santa Monica that moves to, you know, that's able to get 200 acres in Moore Park, which isn't cheap. And so Hollywood.
She's a private chef. They want to eat farm to table. You know, it almost feels like a parody of, you know.
Yeah, we're a long way from Ma and Pa Kettle here. As Claudia said, this is very much from privilege. And, you know, poor farmers can't afford this kind of cinematography.
All right. The film is The Biggest Little Farm at the Landmark in West L.A., the Arclight in Hollywood. John Chester, the director. It's rated PG. Black Mother documentary that's directed by Khaliq Allah. Justin, what'd you think?
I really loved this movie. This is Khaliq Allah's collage. It's a collage-like ode to Jamaica, where his mother is from and where he has spent a lot of time over the years. He's effectively woven this tapestry of these individual portraits, and the effect of watching this movie is very emotional and sensual as well. It's overwhelming on both those levels. His portraits are very wide-ranging. He finds people on the streets, in churches, and stores. He spends a lot of time shooting his own family. And what's really interesting is the way he divorces sound from image. Sometimes they go together, and sometimes he breaks them apart in ways that make you figure out, okay, what am I watching? What am I listening to? It's a very experimental approach to form. A lot of times we're looking at faces, but we're hearing voices that may or may not belong to those people. Early on, he starts off on kind of a throw-you-in-right note. You're hearing this conversation between a prostitute and a potential John as they're like haggling over the price. And that dialogue, though, plays over other footage that is not entirely clear. And then later on in this very, very moving passage, you hear this old woman just praying, and it's this prayer from the gut, and it just goes on for minutes and minutes, and you're just seeing this, again, tapestry of life where there's faces and there's places and there's water imagery. The title of the movie suggests that, you know, all life in this place originates from the Black Mother, and you see an image of a woman whose pregnancy you're following, and it's divided into three sections, which he calls trimesters. And maybe that's the conceit is maybe a little bit precious, and it does build to a scene of childbirth. Childbirth is the theme of the live birth scenes are the theme of the week, clearly. But it's just I just found it so gorgeous. It's shot on 16mm and some 8mm as well. And it's been put together with this roughness so you can see the sprocket holes of the film and you can see the edges of the frame, which gives it just this extraordinary kind of aesthetic vitality, I think. So I really it's very short. It's under 70 minutes. I can't wait to see it again, actually.
Black Mother, the film, takes us to Jamaica. It's unrated at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Khalik Allah, the director. El Chicano, set in East Los Angeles. It actually opened last week. Raul Castillo and Amy Garcia star. The film's directed and co-written by Ben Hernandez Bray. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well, this is being billed as the first Latino superhero story.
Seems hard to believe this, the first of the genre.
What about Spider-Verse? Miles Morales.
That's a good point. He was, yes.
He was animated,
Afro-Latino.
Yes,
right. So the first live-action Latino superhero story. We're adding lots of qualifiers here. But, it has some very riveting moments and some very strong acting. It's directed by Ben Hernandez Bray, co-written by Joe Carnahan, who's done various movies like The Gray. One of the things I like best about it is that it evokes L.A. and especially East L.A. with a lot of references to Chicano and Mexican culture, historical, spiritual, political, from like the Aztec myths to the fate of Ruben Salazar, the journalist. There are references to the Virgin of Guadalupe, Pan Dulce, Zoot Suit Rites. You know, there's a lot, and it may feel like it's a lot to shoehorn in, but you know, given these touchstones of folklore and culture, you know, there are so few movies about Latinos. So I think there's a reason why they kind of feel like
set
the
in
urge.
East LA.
It's set
give you this, yeah. which gives yes. it, which you spend any time in East LA, it's such a sense of place
yes.
and culture. And somehow filmmakers just, it's like, you know,
it's
they
in
haven't
our backyard.
Discovered it.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, here we are in Hollywood and they haven't discovered it. And, you know, occasionally you'll see, you know, some kind of car chase scenes or a bridge or something like that. But yeah, we need to see more films that, well, obviously that are, you know, that involve the Latino community. I mean, this and Curse of La Llorona, you know, are just scraping the surface. But so this has, it's a very gritty world. It's a little bit dark visually sometimes, which is not a great thing. I wish it were a little bit clearer. There are moments of heightened melodrama. El Chicano wears a black mask and he brandishes this Aztec sword, rides around at night in a motorcycle. And he's kind of more of a vigilante, really, but he's meting out vigilante justice. One of the, it's the lead detective who plays kind of a dual role is Raul Castillo, who is in We Are the Animals, and he's great. And his boss, this like hardened LAPD boss, I guess he's a detective or higher up, is played by George Lopez. And he's great in his first serious role that I've ever seen. So the only thing that I had a problem with is, while it's well-intentioned and it is really seeking to instill pride in, you know, sort of Chicano heritage, it does do some fear-mongering with Mexicans, with sort of the Mexican cartel story, in the same way that I had problems with Sicario 2. And, you know, why does it have to be Mexican-Americans against Mexicans? I just feel like that's, I realize, you know, Mexican drug cartels, of course, exist and they are a problem. But I just, that was one of the problems I had with it. But other than that, I think it's worth seeing. There's some clunky dialogue. There's some cliched lines. But I like what it was trying to evoke. And I love the fact that it was set in East L.A.
El Chicano, the film, directed by Ben Hernandez Bray, who co-wrote it with Joe Carnahan. Raul Castillo stars. It's rated R in wide release. The South African romantic drama Rafiki is directed by Wanuri Kahiyu, who co-wrote the screenplay. Claudia?
I really like this film. I think Wanuri Kahiyu is definitely someone to watch. You know, I think the tagline is good Kenyan girls become good Kenyan wives. And these are two young women who want so much more. And it's kind of a Romeo and Juliet, or Juliet and Juliet, I guess, story, in that they come from rival political families. Each of their fathers are running for a political office. And yet the girls become close friends and fall in love. And they also want to pursue their dreams. One of them wants to be a doctor. It's a conservative society. And in fact, it was the first Kenyan film to play at Cannes. And it was banned there because homosexuality is banned. And it's very tastefully done scenes.
Yes. This is a pretty conventional, earnest story that feels like can never be told often enough, and it's told with great passion and heart here, and the actresses are great.
Beautiful.
The visual style is just, I mean, I would recommend it just on the basis of that alone.
Gorgeous.
In a way, the somewhat predictable nature of the story and the earnestness almost didn't matter for me, because it just, the way this director, Kahiu's eye is just so great, and she shows you the world in a way that makes it look new.
The movie is Rafiki. It's unrated. It's at two of the Lemley's theaters, the Glendale and Royal in West Los Angeles. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of black cinema, Hollywood Black, the stars, the films, the filmmakers, from writer Donald Bogle. That to come, along with our Tim Cox Show. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. Public Enemy, from the soundtrack of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Hard to believe that's 30 years ago. Mm. Fight the Power, of course. And we're going to talk about the history of black cinema with a gentleman who is a noted contributor to that field of scholarship, Donald Bogle. He wrote the highly influential book Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies and Bucks, and his brand new book, A Comprehensive Look at Black American Cinema, Hollywood Black, the Stars, the Films, the Filmmakers. Also with us, Tim Cogshill, KPCC Film Week critic. Tim, I understand Donald's first book, there was a textbook you used for your class.
When I first started teaching cinema, it was one of the very, very first books that I used, Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies. And it's always been a part, all of his books, frankly, have been a part of what I've used to teach cinema to all kinds of youth over the last 30 years.
Donald, it's a pleasure to have you back with us on Air Talk. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Larry. And hi, Tim. How are you?
Very good, sir.
So let's start, first of all, with kind of a sad note. John Singleton wrote the foreword to the book, and obviously his passing is a huge loss to American cinema.
Yes, it is. I couldn't quite believe it when he had the stroke and then, of course, when he passed. But John did the foreword for the book, and it was really good to work with him. I didn't know him really well, but what I knew of him, I really liked. I'll tell you something funny about him. He agreed to do the foreword, but he said he wanted to speak to me first. I had met him and everything. And it was hard for me to track him down, for him to track me down, and I wasn't sure how to reach him. And then finally I realized I had his email and phone number, his cell, in my directory. So then we talked, and he began working on the foreword, and he did he had done the beginnings of a draft, the opening and so forth. And he sent it to me, and he said, Donald, I'm still working, but this is the opening. And then he sounded just like a director. He said, start editing. So then I went through and so forth. But I'll say this about John Singleton. Not only did he love making movies, but he loved seeing movies. And he talked about these early things he had seen growing up. You know, he grew up near a drive-in movie theater that he could see from where he lived, but he couldn't hear anything. He just saw the images. And that really helped him to learn how to tell a story through images visually. But there were just many things he had loved seeing. And
we talked about Westerns when we were remembering him, how influential Westerns were in his approach to making movies.
Yes. And also, I mean, he liked blaxploitation, and he liked Pam Grier. He liked Shaft.
Who doesn't?
And he also, yeah, exactly. And also, he did. He really admired Gordon Parks, Gordon Parks Sr., who had directed The Learning Tree and Shaft. And with the foreword, he wanted to talk more about Gordon Parks. And I said, "Well, John, we really just don't have space." I said, save it for your autobiography, and unfortunately, there won't be. But he was a great person to work with. I really enjoyed him.
Donald, let's go back to one of the earliest entrepreneurs in African American cinema, Oscar, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correct. Michel, is that how you say his name?
Well, there, you know, I've said Michel, but some people say that it was sometimes Michal.
Okay.
But I interviewed many years ago a group of actors who had worked for him. Lorenzo Tucker, sometimes called the Black Valentino, B. Freeman, Slick Chester. And I really, it seems to me they did say Michel, not Michal, but others have said that okay. It was often pronounced Michel.
So, Donald, yeah, let's talk about his significance, because he had the opportunity, apparently, to work within studios, and he chose to go his own way.
Well, the interesting thing about him, and it's one thing that just shifted into another focus for me when I was doing this book, The Birth of a Nation is 1915. And really, by the next year, a movement of black filmmakers is beginning. That's early. You have Noble Johnson, who had helped found the Lincoln Motion Picture Company. And shortly after that, you have Oscar Michel. And Michel was altogether amazing, because it was really the Lincoln Motion Picture Company that wanted Michel. They wanted to, he was a self-published novelist, and they wanted to do one of his novels. And he decided he would do it himself. And he just set out to do it. And he was on a tremendous journey, because he went from the silent period into the period of sound. And there were other black independent companies, some white run and owned, others with African Americans. But when sound came in the late 20s, this killed many off, because the new technology was expensive, they had to work with, and so forth. But Michel did keep going, and his last film was released in 1947, a movie called The Betrayal. So he was really, he was in many ways a prototypical director, in that he had real hustle and he had drive, which a director often has to have. And he knew how to work with his actors and actresses. And he also wanted very much, if you see a movie like Within Our Gates, which came out in 1920, where he's really dealing with race and race politics. And it's just amazing to see a filmmaker that early on who's so compelling, the way he does deal with race.
We're talking
about Michel.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to interject, but finish your point, please, Donald. Sorry.
Well, to think that he's different from Hollywood, because Hollywood did move away from that. The Hollywood didn't want to acknowledge racism, but Michel had these strong social, political, racial convictions. And in those early, particularly the silent period, you really see him, a really fascinating filmmaker, challenging America.
Hold that thought. Donald Bogle, author of Hollywood Black, The Stars, The Films, The Filmmakers. We're talking about Oscar Michel, who's such an important figure in film history as an African-American, making his own films, featuring African-Americans for an African-American audience. I do want to play, though, this a clip from Gone with the Wind, because for mainstream American audiences, one of the biggest performances, Hattie McDaniel's as Mammy, 1939's Gone with the Wind. She's the first African-American nominee for an acting performance.
Where are you going without your shawl and not air fixing to set in? And how come you didn't ask them gentlemen to stay for supper? You ain't got no more manners than a field hand. That's to be Miss Ellen done labored with you.
Miss Carter?
Come on in the house. Come on in before you catch your death of dampness.
No, I'm going to wait for Paul to come home from the Wilkes.
Come on in here. Come on.
Tim, this is sort of a two-edged sword, right? Because she's a gifted actor. She's getting recognition. She's well-paid, lived right here in West Adams District of Los Angeles, where she's a prominent figure in the arts community of L.A., but playing this stereotypical character.
Yeah, and certainly in the years after that role and after winning that Academy Award, the black community certainly felt that she came to represent a sort of Aunt Jemima, a sort of stereotype of black women in cinema. At the time, this was not true. In the moment, this was not true. In the moment, black folks admired her strength on the screen. You'll notice that she's the one in charge of what's happening with the white lady there. And this was the way that a lot of black folks saw her, and particularly when they contextualized her character with the people in their own family. She looks just like my mother's my father's mother.
And her winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, I assume, was very well received by African Americans.
It was well received at the time. But, you know, one thing about Gone with the Wind, there was criticism, first of Margaret Mitchell's novel, published in 1936, and then there was criticism coming from the African American community about its depiction of slavery. And then when David O. Selznick was announced he was going to do the film, there was great concern about what would happen. Selznick himself, he did not want Gone with the Wind to be A Birth of a Nation. He did not want it to be what he called, he didn't want it to be an anti-Negro film. So he took certain precautions. There's a Klan incident in Margaret Mitchell's novel that he got rid of the Klan. Of course, D.W. Griffin in Birth of a Nation had featured the Ku Klux Klan. But what Tim was saying about Hattie McDaniel, it is true that there was excitement over her winning the Oscar. This was the highest award that Hollywood could bestow on an actor or actress or filmmaker. And so there she had won it. It's interesting when you see the Negro press at that time and the way the press dealt with Hattie McDaniel. I'm thinking about the California publication California Eagle, that basically black actors and actresses, despite the stereotypes, they were, for a time, they were supported, the fact that they were getting work, but there was this concern about what these roles were.
All right, we need to break. Donald Bogle, Hollywood Black, the stars, the films, the filmmakers. We'll be back in 1 minute on Film Week. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. This is the first major studio blaxploitation film. Gordon Parks directing, Richard Roundtree as John Shaft in the film Shaft, which would spawn a couple of sequels, even a CBS TV series starring Roundtree. Let's listen, though, from the original 1971 film, Roundtree as Shaft, in a scene with Lawrence Pressman playing Lieutenant Tom Hannon.
I thought you might know something I want to know. Seems to have been a lot of low, quiet rumbles going on uptown. Our people have been able to pick up the sounds of it, but no words.
That's because us black folk talk mush mouth, Lieutenant.
I thought we were going to get to it.
We did, but you want me to pigeon. I just said, up yours, baby.
How come a couple of cats from Harlem come downtown this morning looking for John Shaft?
Well, they're soul brothers. They came down so I could teach them to handshake.
I just saw Shaft again recently. Donald Bogle, author of Hollywood Black. And I mean, it's just great because he is such an authoritative figure trying to work within this system and carve out his autonomy. It's a great character.
Yeah, it is a great character. You know, one thing a point I did want to make, Larry, in terms of, for your listeners with this book, that it goes through the 20th century into the new millennium. And before Shaft, there was a shift in the movies after World War II and in the 50s with the rise of dramatic stars like Sidney Poitier and Dorothy Dandridge, who should not be forgotten. Mm. Dandridge getting an Oscar nomination for her performance in 1954's Carmen Jones. That was historic. Hattie McDaniel had won for supporting. Dandridge gets the nomination in a leading category. Poitier is a major force. But with Shaft, what happens after the emergence and really superstardom of Sidney Poitier, there is a change in the audience, particularly the black audience. And the black audience wants a more assertive kind of black hero, not so much with this theme of racial reconciliation, which happens in Poitier's films. This really is part of the reason for the rise of what we know as blaxploitation film. Gordon Parks did not consider his film blaxploitation, nor did Melvin Van Peebles consider his groundbreaking film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song blaxploitation. But those movies now announce the arrival of a new kind of hero, and he's not going to take anything, as your listeners can hear from that sound. bite that you just played. So blaxploitation gives us these assertive heroes and challenging the system as it was. And it was a great thing in the movies. Blaxploitation did not last very long. By, I would say, 75, 76, it's changing. And you have the emergence in the late 70s of someone like Richard Pryor, and then in the 80s, Eddie Murphy. And now we're back to something else, where it's not so much movies being made in particular for African-American audiences, as was the case with the blaxploitation era. But now there's the idea of the crossover star, the black star who will be in a movie that will appeal to audiences, to white audiences, as well as to black audiences. And so we get something else happening then. Also, the age itself is not as politically driven as the late 60s and 1970s were. But Gordon Parks, it's interesting that with Shaft, and I'll try to make this quick because I know I've got to be
yeah,
concise.
Yeah, you're almost out of time, Donald.
yeah, that Shaft, we see him coming up at the opening out of the subway. And it's like a man who's been underground, Gordon Parks is telling us, and he's coming up into this world now, and he's going against traffic. And so all of that is very invigorating for a young black audience at that time to see, and for us to see it today.
And it was a huge hit cross-racially among audiences as well. I do want to go back to Poitier because he is such a singular figure in the evolution of American film. And Tim, speak to his importance, the types of roles that he played and the kind of gravitas that he brought to those.
Well, the two big ones are interesting, both 1967. So guess who's coming to dinner? A film that a whole bunch of black folks took him to task for making, where he had to be this acceptable black figure in the context of
the perfect doctor.
The perfect doctor, the perfect black man. Same year, though, in The Heat of the Night. This is a movie where he plays a detective from Philadelphia who, before that movie is over, slaps a white judge in the face. Funny that Sidney doesn't get as much credit for that as he gets, taken down for the thing in the other movie. Very interesting there. Later in his career, we'll see that Sidney, when he starts directs movies like Buck and the Preacher with him and Harry Belafonte, where they are these sort of definitive black men leading their black tribe into the West, out of the old West and into the modern times. They got guns, they got horses, they ain't taking nothing from nobody. So Sidney became aware of that legacy, and he wanted to make sure he corrected it a little bit as he moved toward the middle 70s.
I love In the Heat of the Night. I just, that again, Virgil Tibbs, a great character it's the fish out of water story, but with the racial component of the African-American man from the city, from Philly in the Deep South.
If I can just toss in real quick, I have sister Pam Grier. Pam Grier, Brown. Let me point out that a black woman was an above-the-title star in action movies, doing what Steve McQueen did in movies in the early 70s. That's where we were at that time. We backtrack quite a bit, but that's where we were at that time.
Yeah, don't forget Tamara Dobson,
Teresa Graves, black women starring in these movies, playing tough black women.
Tim, as always, thanks so much. Appreciate your being with us. Tweeze on down the road with Michael Jackson from The Wiz. Tim Cockshell, our critic, and our thanks to Donald Bogle, Hollywood Black, the stars, the films, the filmmakers, his new book. Donald, a pleasure. Thank you so much
for being
here.
My pleasure, Larry.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tim.
All right, Donald.
All right, it's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend.